Yes. Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Obviously, this is a fairly experimental talk, and it's a fairly theoretical audience. So if there are any questions at any point, just stop me, and I'll try my best to explain. So before I start, I thought I would tell, I'm not sure how many of you have been to Durham, so I thought I'd, very good. I thought I'd tell you where we are. So we're in, because lots of people have been asking me where Durham is. So it's up here. So let me get this working. So we're up right in the northeast corner of the UK. Actually, we're closer to Scotland. The border to Scotland is up here than we are to London. Newcastle, about 15 miles or so. Really close to Newcastle. Yep. And we're an old, well, the third oldest university in England, after two others whose name escapes me at the moment. And the physics department is fairly large. Actually, we have a big intake of students. There are 60 or so staff, of which seven or eight are doing atomic physics. So we're a fairly big atomic physics group in the UK. Actually, Durham's a beautiful place. It's surrounded by beautiful countryside. The coast is basically just like the coast here. There's a few more clouds. But it has lots of nice castles, and actually there's this Roman wall across the country which they built to keep out the Scots from the north. Okay. Durham itself is dominated by a cathedral. So this is our city centre. Okay, so it's well worth visiting. Here's the cathedral and the castle. And the physics department is kind of down here. Okay, so it's just a short walk from the city centre. It's very pleasant. And the cathedral, of course, is famous for Harry Potter. Actually, some of the early films were filmed there, and we quite like this connection. In fact, you can get lessons in flying broomsticks. So this is my two eldest children. They've mastered the art of flying the broomstick. Okay. So that's Durham. So let me tell you a little bit about some science and some our work towards rubidium cesium ground state molecules. Okay, so our goal actually is one shared by many people, namely to make this quantum array of polar molecules. And it was really these early papers in 2002 and 2003 that identified the idea of taking your two BECs, putting them in an optical lattice, controlling the interactions in such a way that you end up with this beautiful miscible state, this ideal state where you have one atom of each species on each lattice site. And then, of course, you just convert those to ground state molecules, and you have your array of polar molecules. And actually, rubidium cesium, for some reasons, turns out to be quite nice. It's one of the species that's stable against these reactive collisions. And actually, from an experimental point of view, it's very easy to align these molecules. So you need quite modest electric fields to generate an appreciable dipole. Okay. And as you know, the motivation here is to generate these dipolar quantum gases where we have this long-range anisotropic interaction. And there are many different applications that you can use this kind of system four, many of which we heard about in the conference, and you mentioned again yesterday, quantum simulation and studying these novel phases, as well as chemistry and precision measurement. Okay. I have to say that actually saying this step of just turning two atoms into a molecule, you can say it very easily. And actually, I think the field has been somewhat surprised by actually how readily that has been demonstrated. And so the route, which has now been established, is to first create this high phase-based density mixture of your chosen species, and then associate using a magnetic Feshbach resonance. So just sweep the magnetic field across this Feshbach resonance and couple your free atoms into this high-lying bound state. And then the real magic is this process of stimulated Raman adiabatic passage to transfer with two laser photons from this very, very weakly bound molecular state down into the absolute ground state. And this was really pioneered in Innsbruck and in Gila, working in cesium-2 and rubidium-2 in the triplet state, and of course in the KRB system that we've heard a lot about. Okay. So what I'm going to tell you about today, this is the kind of outline. I'll give you an introduction to the experiment, because it's quite, many of you have heard about the Innsbruck experiment during the conference. Ours is very different, as you'll see. How we create two species BECs, and what we've done looking at the Fleischbach structure in that system. And I'll show you a little bit about how we've made some Fleischbach molecules. And then towards the end, looking forwards to transferring those to the ground state, and an experiment which is just about coming online with ytterbium and cesium as opposed to rubidium and cesium. Okay. So I should first of all introduce the atoms. Okay. So this was my motivation for choosing rubidium cesium many years ago. Cesium is actually a beautiful atom to work with. It has this really rich Fleischbach structure, which allows you to do many, many interesting things. Rubidium-87, in contrast, this is the scattering length as a function of magnetic field. It looks rather dull, but actually that makes your life a lot easier as an experimentalist if you only have one complicated system to worry about. And cesium is complicated, so this is the magnetically trappable state, which suffers from quite high two-body inelastic decay, and people tend not to work in this state so much. So you concentrate on the absolute internal ground state, where these two-body inelastic collisions are not energetically allowed. But even here, so there's a region here, the scattering length is negative, so we can't make condensates. Here, we have high three-body loss, which scales as the fourth power of the scattering length. So actually, this is where you work if you want to make a BEC in cesium. So it's a narrow window around 20 Gauss is predominantly where a lot of the work is done.
That includes a narrow resonance?
There is a narrow resonance at...
Is that useful or is it...
It is, actually. So I'll show you later how we use that to make molecules. And when we began this project, we had no idea what the rubidium-cesium scattering length was. Now, actually, through a combination of what we've done and Jeremy's work, Jeremy Hudson over in chemistry in Durham, and of course the Innsbruck team, so they identified a sequence of resonances below 600 Gauss, which Jeremy has managed to assign and fit, and now the scattering length, the interspecies scattering length, is fairly well established. Two things to point out. First of all, okay, it looks good for magneto-association. There are many resonances to choose from. But something which is very important, which will come up time and time again, is that the background scattering length in the system is actually fairly large. So it's about 650 Bohr or so, which is both good and bad, as you'll see. Okay. So our experiment is very simple. So we start. We collect atoms in what is known as a pyramid knot, and you can just think of this as generating a cold beam of rubidium and cesium, which we collect in a glass cell, and we transfer into an optical dipole trap. And so all of the measurements I'll show are just done in a very simple optical dipole trap, a cross-beam dipole trap. And we can generate magnetic fields up to about 1,200 Gauss or so. So the trap we use is actually, well, we call it a levitated dipole trap. So in addition to these two beams which cross, we also apply a magnetic field gradient to cancel out gravity acting on the atoms. And we can tune that gradient. So some of the things we do, for example, is we can tilt the trap by adding various amounts of gradient across it. And this is useful sometimes for evaporative cooling of the species. Our trap depths are such that there's a ratio. The trap is deeper for cesium than it is for rubidium, which will prove important. It's deeper by about a factor of 1.4 or so. Yep.
Does that mean that you only trap low-dose seekers or high-dose
seekers? So I'll come on to that. So we can trap both. So one of the nice features is that for rubidium and cesium, their magnetic moment to mass ratio is actually about the same. So you can levitate both species with the same magnetic field gradient. So actually we can get very good overlap in principle of the two species and cancel gravity for them both simultaneously. So you asked about the states we use. So to load this trap, what we first do is evaporative cooling in a magnetic quadrupole trap. So here we're in a weak field seeking state. And what we do is we sympathetically cool the cesium. So we make use of this large cross section and we sympathetically cool the cesium. So you see there's very little atom loss of cesium as we cool on the rubidium, and the collisions lead to rethermalization of the cesium. And then to load our dipole trap, we simply ramp down this quadrupole gradient and the atoms transfer into that dipole trap. And aligning that is very easy because at this stage, when we're in a magnetically trappable state and we still have a gradient, this leads to magnetic confinement along the dipole trap as well. So we can transfer very efficiently into our dipole trap. And then once we're in the dipole trap, we simply ramp down the intensity of the laser and we can create rubidium BEC. I mentioned at the beginning, to work with cesium, we have to be in this low field seeking state. So we are able to manipulate the spins. So we start out, for example, here with rubidium in the -1 state, 1-1, and we can transfer nearly all the population over to the other state and then work in the absolute internal state. So I'll often refer to this as the AA channel.
We still have the gradient at this point.
We still have the gradient, and yes, we reverse the gradient effectively so that we're levitating this state.
Okay, so you only work with one state at a time?
Yeah, because we have to switch the coils around in order to work with one state or the other. Yeah. And when we do this, we can load cesium quite efficiently, and we can evaporate and produce also cesium BECs in this way. One point of interest is actually we tried and tried to do cesium alone, but we didn't get very good transfer into the dipole trap. So again, this large interspecies scattering length is actually beneficial in the transfer into the dipole trap. Having this bath of rubidium helps us transfer cesium into our optical trap. And one thing that's already I've mentioned very, very important is this tuning of the magnetic field. Okay, so there's a reasonable window over which we can create BECs. So this is looking at the number and the temperature. But everything in cesium is field dependent. Okay, so it's not trivial just to switch magnetic field. You can see there's a strong dependence. You see narrow resonances. And this variation in the background scattering length also is important. But just to demonstrate, so here, the fact that we've got cesium BEC, we can tune the interactions. So this is just images in time of flight where we're changing the magnetic field, and you can either induce a collapse by going to negative scattering lengths where the system implodes. You can go to something close to zero scattering length where it's essentially frozen and doesn't expand, or we can go to large positive scattering lengths and look at a strong mean field repulsion. Okay. So the other side of this large interspecies scattering length is the fact that we get large interspecies loss. Okay, so unfortunately this gives us this big three-body loss. So here you can see, for example, we put a large amount of rubidium, a small amount of cesium, and we just see the cesium disappear very rapidly. So this is always something you have to deal with in the rubidium 87 cesium system.
Is it rubidium to cesium loss, or is it rubidium plus cesium plus cesium?
I don't know, actually. It's very hard to differentiate between the two. But we can get around that. So what we do is actually we just load far less cesium into the trap to keep the cesium density as low as possible. So this is, if we produce a cesium alone BEC, we'd start up here. So we just reduce the number of cesium atoms by an order of magnitude, and then we rely on sympathetic cooling with the rubidium, and we can actually cool both species to degeneracy. And we did this really just fractionally before the scattering lengths were really established. And what we observe when we do so is actually this phase separation. Okay, so these are images of the rubidium and the cesium condensates with a appreciable thermal background. And what you see is these structures emerge, which seem to correlate with the relative number of atoms in each species. So we can get this phase separation. And this is easy to understand. It's been observed in other systems. Okay, it's just the relative interaction strengths of the two condensates. And actually this, I mean, at the time we worked out that this established that the interspecies scattering length was greater than this limit based upon the knowledge of the individual scattering lengths. And this, of course, now is well known and established through the flashback spectrum that indeed this background scattering length is about 654. And this, as I say, our structures are very reminiscent of many papers. Here's just one example where people predicted these kind of structures. And this is something we'd like to revisit. Actually, our main agenda is to make molecules, but we think this is also very interesting, looking at the two species dynamics in this system. Okay, so that's an introduction to the experiment and how we get these high phase-based density mixtures. I'd like now to talk about looking at the Feshbach spectrum, which leads naturally on to the creation of molecules. Okay. So this, let me emphasize again, is the scattering length for rubidium 87 and cesium in the AA channel. So this is both species in the absolute ground state. So what we've done is, because of this large background scattering length, which inhibits many of the different things we'd like to do, and particularly the cooling of both species, so we've focused on looking at some S-wave resonances, and particularly looking at these broader resonances out here. So there are five S-wave resonances in total, and we've identified all of those in the experiment. So this is a typical signature. What happens is you evaporate across this resonance. You see a big loss in atoms as you hit the pole of the resonance where the scattering length diverges. But then there's also a peak in the atom number when you hit the zero in the scattering. So this allows you to measure the width. And one of the things we'd like to return to is actually particularly some of these broader resonances. You see they're 2 Gauss wide, 4 Gauss, and 8 Gauss, 8 or 9 Gauss. Is actually to use the tunability of the interspecies interactions here in the vicinity of these resonances to try and improve our initial conditions for producing molecules and to avoid this phase separation. So we're very fortunate that in across the road we have Jeremy, and we were all, actually the Innsbruck people were also battling this large background scattering length. And our experiment actually switches very readily between rubidium 87 and rubidium 85. And so we asked Jeremy, so what happens in rubidium 85? And he gave us a prediction. He could scale the potentials that he'd fitted for rubidium 87. And he gave us this nice prediction for rubidium 85. And here, very interestingly, the background scattering length now is almost zero. Okay. So no longer do we have this problem that we have a large interspecies scattering length and large losses associated with it. In fact, the two gases basically don't interact or shouldn't interact. So we set about checking this and seeing what we could achieve in the rubidium 85 cesium system. Okay. And the nice way of detecting these resonances, actually we can detect very simply through rethermalization. Okay, so if we look at the temperature of the two species, so this is rubidium and this is cesium, as a function of the magnetic field. Remember I said that the trap depths have roughly a ratio of 1.4, so because the background scattering length is almost zero, away from a resonance, the two gases don't interact. And they come into equilibrium at some temperature set by the trap depths. Okay, so we get two different temperatures. But as soon as we move on to a resonance, the cesium now gets sympathetically cooled by the colder rubidium, and we see a concurrent increase in the rubidium temperature as it has an increased heat load. And similarly, you see this also in the number. The rubidium number drops and the cesium number goes up because now we're not evaporating on the cesium, it's being sympathetically cooled in the trap. And this is a very sensitive way of detecting these interspecies resonances in this case. And we, yep.
Can I just say this frequency of the rubidium, order of magnitude in the number of the cesium and rubidium atoms? Difference?
This difference, this ratio?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's we do that deliberately so that effectively it gives us a little bit more sensitivity in that we're always in a regime where the cesium is going to be sympathetically cooled by the rubidium. We can control this ratio and it is an important parameter. Yeah. So we can scan then the entire magnetic field and we see very good agreement. So this is looking again at the temperature. You see a broad region where there's no rethermalization because this background scattering length is very small in this case. And then there are two quite broad S-wave resonances which give these windows where we get rethermalization. And we can pick out narrow resonances. These two features which don't match the theory, everything pretty much lines up. These two, after the referees complained quite rightly that we hadn't identified them, after about a month or so, we found out these were actually due to the dipole trap laser that we were using. It's kind of interesting in that our laser frequencies are offset by 100 megahertz from one another in order to avoid creating an optical lattice. And these two beams being offset by 100 megahertz actually drives some kind of Raman transition at this field resonantly and creates a feature which looks just like a Feshbach resonance. So that's potentially something that could be interesting in its own right in the future. So just to summarize, we've seen 9 resonances experimentally, and they all line up very well with what Jeremy calculates. There are 2 nice P-wave resonances and 2 very broad resonances, which actually come out at 200 and something Gauss wide. I should stress that actually one of the interesting things here is because the background scattering length is very small, interpreting the resonance's width is somewhat different from the normal case. So I don't think these are really 200 Gauss wide in the same sense. One of the things that came out of this actually is we saw also some intra-species resonances. So this is a scan across this 370 Gauss range. And what you see is in the rubidium number 2 very clear features. But when we look at this rethermalization in cesium, there's only one feature present. And actually it then turned out that this was this is a rubidium-rubidium resonance that we were also detecting in the experiment. So we had a little diversion. Actually, rubidium-85 I worked on as a postdoc many years ago, and actually have another experiment where we work with rubidium-85. But that's a very somewhat unexplored atom. So we completed some Feshbach spectroscopy of rubidium-85, which may be of interest to people. Particularly, we looked again in this AA channel, which really hasn't been studied at all, where there is a broad resonance. So the thing about rubidium-85 is that the background scattering length is moderately large and negative. So if you need to make a BEC, you need a fairly broad resonance to tune to a positive scattering length. Okay, and there is actually one down in this 2 plus 2 state, the absolute internal state, which is about a Gauss or so wide. And we also set the experiment. We can also work in the 2 minus 2 state, and we've seen a whole bunch of resonances there which have not been really published before. This is the usual resonance for those that are familiar with the collapse work and the work in Jiller on rubidium-85. This is the usual 155 Gauss resonance where people make condensates. So let's see how we can use these resonances now to make molecules. All right. So remember, the recipe is to create a high phase-based density mixture. I've shown you how we can do that. The next step is then to associate, use this magneto-association on one of these resonances that we've identified. All right. So that again sounds simple, but in reality, what it means is coupling from the bare atomic states into this zoo of bound states, which exist very close to threshold. Okay. And at the same time, we have this challenge of the scattering lengths. So somehow we can't just dial up any field, because we've got to deal with the fact that we've got many scattering lengths in the problem. Okay, so there's the cesium alone scattering length, which puts some quite stringent requirements on what you have to do. This rubidium 87 cesium system has the large background scattering length, which makes it difficult to cool at any arbitrary field. Rubidium 85, if we work with that, has a large negative scattering length. So we've removed this large background scattering length, so we've solved one problem, but in effect we've introduced a different problem. So what we did, as experimentalists, what you always do, is find something simple to do first. Okay, so we avoided the problem of dealing with all these scattering lengths by just focusing on cesium alone. Okay, and we played around a little bit, just making cesium 2 dimers. Okay, so as you pointed out, in this magic window where you can create cesium condensates, there is a narrow, it's a G-wave resonance. To 19.8 Gauss, and we can sweep the magnetic field simply across this resonance and couple into this bound state. Okay, and typically what one does in these kind of experiments is, because this has a different magnetic moment, what we do is then turn off the trap. Okay, so the power in the dipole trap is switched off. We leave a magnetic field gradient on, and we let the two, the molecular cloud and the atomic cloud, separate, just due to the Stern-Gerlach effect. And then afterwards, after we've separated them, we would sweep back across the resonance to dissociate the molecules and then image the atoms. Okay, so this is
what happens.
There's a movie of exactly that. So we've swept across the resonance, and we're letting the molecules, in this case, are falling. And the atoms are actually slightly moving up, because our magnetic field gradients, it's a little bit too high to levitate them. And this way you can measure, for example, you can measure the magnetic moment and the molecules, and really get some insight into this bound state spectrum. And of course, from the expansion of this, you can measure the temperature of the molecules. And in this case, it really just reflects the temperature of the atomic gas beforehand. One thing you have to be careful of course, when you dissociate, you jump back above the resonance, so you jump back up and you give the dissociated atoms a certain amount of energy. So be careful not to misread the temperature.
Are they G-wave molecules?
Yes.
Yeah, they should come out. I mean, G-wave, right? So they should actually
be probably in an NL. Yeah, so we don't leave, I guess we haven't looked and left it long enough to observe that. Yeah. Okay. So you can play around, actually. So we had a lot of fun with this. So what you notice in this bound state spectrum is, as you go down in magnetic field, there's an avoided crossing here where the magnetic moment changes. And then it changes into something which is running parallel to the atomic state. So it essentially has a magnetic moment equal to that of the atoms. Okay. And because we have a magnetic field gradient, as the atoms fall, they're going to lower and lower magnetic field. So eventually they'll cross this avoided crossing. And when they do so, they will start to feel a force coming back up. Okay, and so you can make these beautiful pictures where we've coupled out the molecules, they've fallen, their magnetic moment has changed. And so effectively they've bounced back up. And then, of course, they go back through the avoided crossing.
The magnetic moment
changes again, and then they start to fall again. So we get these nice oscillations. And these were first observed, I think, in the rubidium 87 case by the Munich group. The other thing we can do, which is kind of fun, is actually output couple many pulses of molecules from the same cloud. So here what we do is we sweep across the resonance. The molecules start to fall, and they fall to lower magnetic fields. So if you look at this first pulse, the magnetic field, as a function of time, it starts to fall due to gravity. We can then jump the magnetic field back across the resonance for the atoms, but keep the molecules bound. So you see the magnetic field, the dashed line here, doesn't cross the resonance again. So the molecules don't dissociate, and then we can jump across again and output couple a second pulse. Okay. And actually, so these are images which all come from a single atomic cloud. Okay, we can do this. Actually, we've done it up to, I think, about 30 pulses or so from the same atomic cloud. And basically, the efficiency of coupling drops simply due to the fact that we're depleting the phase space density in the atomic cloud in the beginning. But the first few pulses are actually fairly even in the number of molecules we can put into them. So then what we wanted to do was to combine these two effects, which we did, in the hope of seeing a collision between two molecular clouds. So here what we've done is we've output coupled two molecular clouds from the atomic cloud. The gradient is set such that this atomic cloud shoots off and the molecules are more or less levitated, they're not quite. And we jump the magnetic field so that in this region the magnetic moment is such that the atoms, the molecules are forced upwards, and in this region they come back down. And so here, as a function of time, we were able to engineer this collision between the two molecular clouds. Unfortunately, I think our density is such that so far we've seen no evidence of any kind of interaction between the two clouds. But this has some potential interest if we can increase the density, and also for, I think it should be possible also to accumulate molecules in this way by trapping these. So that's all cesium 2. Rubidium 87 cesium is somewhat more complicated, and again this is this large background scattering length. The fact that the background scattering length is large actually means there's a band state very close to threshold. So when you sweep across a resonance, so for example if we sweep across this resonance, what we do is we couple into this band state close to threshold, which has essentially the same magnetic moment as the atoms, and the molecules and the atoms don't separate, they collide and the molecules just dissociate very rapidly.
So instead
what we have to do is change the magnetic field very rapidly, so we sweep across here at a certain rate, which we optimize for the coupling, but then we have to jump the magnetic field quite rapidly down, actually through this state and right down here, where we have a magnetic moment that allows us to separate the molecules from the atoms. And we can
do that either
by turning off the trap and just doing the same Stern-Gerlach separation, or we can leave the trap on and switch the gradient to levitate this state. So when we jump down to here, effectively what we do is pull the atoms up out of the trap and hopefully leave the molecules. And the current status is that as of a few weeks ago, we can make roughly 5,000 or so rubidium cesium
molecules. This is very similar
to what they create in Innsbruck in the Feshbach state. We can measure the magnetic moment and it agrees with what Jeremy calculates in this band state picture reasonably well. And we can trap those molecules, so they're trapped in the dipole trap at a density approaching 10 to the 10 or so, and they have a lifetime of a couple of hundred milliseconds. Actually, I should point out that actually the dipole trap under these conditions is such that it doesn't trap atoms at all. So these atoms, when we do this, are really pulled out and there is no potential which can confine the atoms. So this is a very pure molecular gas in the trap. So just as an outlook, of course, that's all well and good, but to get a dipole moment, we need to really transfer down into this row vibrational ground state. And we've done these two steps, but this is quite a challenge in that these two laser wavelengths are very different and need to be very accurately stabilized with respect to one another. But that's underway. Actually, we hope.
Well, I hope.
In the next month or so that we'll start firing the lasers at the molecules. So we have a very nice cavity which is set up with the two lasers injected into it, and they both can be locked to the cavity, and hopefully we can do this transfer very quickly because a lot of the work has been done in Innsbruck, so we know the wavelengths very well. So let me
in the last
10 minutes or so, just tell you a little bit about another experiment, which is very close, and that's using ytterbium and cesium. And this is really motivated by the fact that a lot of proposals exist where you'd like to create a molecule which not only has an electric dipole moment, but also a magnetic moment, or effectively a spin, which you get if you couple and make a molecule out of a two-electron atom and a one-electron atom. And ytterbium, as we saw also in the conference, is very nice in that it has a whole bunch of isotopes that you can play with, some of which are bosons and some are fermions. It also has this nice intercombination line for laser cooling, so from a technical point of view you can get it very cold very easily, which makes it a nice atom to work with. Of course, there's a price you always pay, there's always a price, but I'll come on to that. Why have we paired it with cesium? Well, actually that basically comes down to the fact that in all of these types of experiments you never really know what you're going to get in terms of the collision behavior until you actually do it. So by pairing it with cesium we kind of
get more tickets
for the lottery,
if you like, because
by changing the ytterbium isotope
we can actually scale the reduced mass
in the system, that scales the whole potential and gives you another chance at getting nice collision properties. Okay, so this is actually some work from Axel Gurlitt's group, who we work with, where he has ytterbium and rubidium, and you can see the same effect, that you can tune the scattering length effectively by changing the isotope. This is even more pronounced in cesium because you really the masses are much more similar. Whereas, for example, in the ytterbium-lithium system, changing the ytterbium isotope doesn't change the collision properties.
So when you say you change the isotope, do you just have all the isotopes in there and
you always get
just tune into one particular one?
Yeah, so you just tune the lasers to trap a different isotope. Yeah. Yeah. The price you pay is that, the alkalis, where you can just have a simple atomic source. Ytterbium, you have to heat a lump of metal to several hundred degrees, which means an oven and then a Siemens lower. So the apparatus is much more complicated. And rather than having a nice little glass cell, we have a huge stainless steel chamber. And that's in part because, there's a lot of laser beams that need to go in to manipulate the two species. And the optical trapping is a little bit more complicated because the standard laser wavelength of 1064 makes a very, very deep trap for cesium and quite a shallow trap for ytterbium. And cesium doesn't like a deep, tight trap. So we have to use a combination of 532 and 1064. The 532 is, of course, repulsive for cesium and so makes the trap shallower. So
this way you can balance out
the two traps and have quite a flexible system. So this is all built. So here it is. We like to show pictures of hardware. And actually, of a few weeks ago, we have a cesium MOT, and the ytterbium MOT is hopefully on the way very soon.
How is the slope?
This is 70 centimeters, I'll say, which actually is because of the cesium. The cesium is harder to slow. So in this case, we fire both ytterbium and cesium simultaneously down.
So the question
is, how do you make molecules in this system? So actually, Jeremy gave a very nice talk at the conference, and he pointed out a couple of years ago that actually, so initially everybody thought that in this case, the usual coupling that exists in the alkalis wouldn't be present when you pair a two-electron atom with a one-electron atom. However, he pointed out that this hyperfine coupling constant will actually change as a function of the internuclear separation as you bring up your ytterbium atom close to rubidium, for example. And that gives you a coupling which can potentially give rise to some Feshbach resonances. But we also saw in the conference that there are other all optical techniques, or the idea of also using some of these metastable states. So there's potentially a number of different ways in which you could create molecules in this system. Okay?
So do you think you can see those resonances?
That's what we're going for, yeah.
We're
going to try both. I mean, initially we will just try and identify loss features in the standard way. So Jeremy keeps saying we have to create 5,000 Gauss.
At
a milligauss, yeah. So we think 2,000 Gauss at maybe 10 milligauss is certainly possible to start with. Again, I mean, the first step is really to establish the background scattering length. So we need to do some experiments looking at just interspecies collisions or some kind of photo association in order to establish the scattering length. And then once Jeremy knows that, he can then say the resonance should be here. And then you can narrow down the window, because the prospect of searching 5,000 Gauss in 1 milligauss steps doesn't sound very inviting. Okay. So let me end, just give a quick summary. So I told you about how we can create two species BECs. Actually, we see this nice phase separation, which is something we'd like to explore more fully. There's lots of nice interspecies resonances, both in rubidium-87 and rubidium-85. And one of the things we want to do is upgrade our dipole trap such that we can potentially start associating rubidium-85 cesium molecules rather than 87. And hopefully in the next couple of months we will start doing STIRAP, and this ytterbium cesium experiment is nearly online as well. So I should end by acknowledging my group, which we tried to levitate here in the same way as our molecules. I won't comment on the magnetic moment to mass ratio of the various people.
Say
I'm quite high, so that's quite good. I should also acknowledge Jeremy's group and a former postdoc who's now back in Taiwan, who did a lot of the rubidium cesium work. And the ytterbium cesium work is a collaboration with Ed Hines's group at Imperial and Mike Tong. Okay. So I shall end there and thank you for your attention.
For the ytterbium cesium, is there any preference in the fermionic or bosonic isotope that
you
plan to use?
So initially, I think we'll just simply use the most abundant isotope, just because it makes life easier. I think the fermionic case is very interesting. Of course, for the ytterbium cesium molecule, it's hardly bound at all. I mean, it's only bound by about 100 Wade numbers or so. So ultimately, we'll have to put, whatever we do, we'll have to put the system into an optical lattice. So it really will, I think, really will be dictated by what the scattering lengths are, so that we can get this miscible phase in the optical lattice. But unfortunately, you never know until you do the experiment what the scattering lengths are going to be. So picking the isotope, I think, will be dictated by which combination of ytterbium isotope and cesium gives the nicest scattering behavior. Yeah. At least in the first instance. There is the possibility of putting in multiple isotopes, of course, but that just makes life even more complicated. It's about 0.2 dBi, I think.
0.2 dBi?
Yeah, I think that's the number. Actually, John Bone.
I didn't know that.
It was a calculation from John Bone quite a few years ago. He had a paper on EDM measurements.
Oh, it was in my
Yeah. So the number that I know is in that paper. Yeah.
So 0.2 is not so big, I guess,
for... No, it's not so big. No.
But
the mass is large. The rotational constant. Yeah.
Oh yes. Yes.
Well, I think you don't need such a large electric field because the mass is very large.
You'll be used to high fields, but
yeah.
Then, you know,
yeah.
Working with the
very
fields.
That's right. Yeah. No, it is a worrying that Jeremy's. I mean, whatever happens, I mean, his point is still the case that the width of the resonance. Really scales with the magnetic field. So the higher the magnetic field is, the greater the chance.
Right. Good,
yeah. Actually, down the corridor we have, well, the superconductivity group have 5 or 10 Tesla magnets. That's right. We'll just combine the two and life will be fine, I'm sure.
Essentials from them in the hallway, isn't it?
Well, already the fringe fields from their magnets, it doesn't affect my lab, but there's a cold atom lab across the corridor, and when they turn on their magnets, you can actually see their magneto-optical trap just shifts. So, yeah.
Which lab is that?
That's Charles Adams' lab. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, no. When they run the magnet, we have to close off the corridor, so we can't have people wandering down the corridor when that magnet is on. Yeah.
And credit cards.
Yeah, and credit cards.
And
yeah.
The doctor knows the story about this in the they had this high magnetic field lab somewhere in the corner between Germany and France, and they put a. Yeah, was it in Grenoble? I thought it was somewhere small. Anyway, so they had this superconducting, really kind of 100 Tesla magnet for the first time, and they wanted to test this on how what the effect on living organisms. So what they did, they put a dose into the magnet, and kind of let the magnetic field go for a while, and then they took the dose off, and the dose was fine. Only this had cold feet. It did it again, and every time it had cold feet. And they really didn't understand it until after a while they figured that just this high magnetic field creates such an airstream. So I don't know what. Sorry, this was. But
Is there a subway?
It
also costs.
In
Durham? Not in Durham, no.
In Africa,
there's a Subway sandwich shop, but...
I guess when they ring those bells in the cathedral.
Yeah.
Looks like you have to another couple of effects to determine before...
Yeah, I think before we get the sensitivity.
What are you going to use in molecules?
What are we going to do? Well, I think the first thing is we're just going to look at their lifetime and see if we can see some sticking. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, ultimately, so we want to put the system into an optical lattice.
But you have the same immiscible problem, right?
With rubidium 87, we do, yes. But I think.
So you would go with the.
Yeah, we will try and switch to 85.
So you would like to associate them in the lattice?
Yeah.
And for that, so I mean, you're starting with a modern Schrödinger state of either.
This would be the ideal. I think initially we will do the association just in free space, but then ultimately we would like.
What's the orthogonal root? I mean, is it you start with the atoms and then the modulator, that's better.
Yeah, that's
the
better.
That seems like that's the way of the future.
Yeah.
Can you that way create a lattice with the unit?
It remains to be seen. I think actually this. You know, in the proposals, this idea of just creating a two-species Mach insulator is obviously very easy, but in practice, it really is not so straightforward in the terms of you have different lattice depths and you have different scattering lengths and you have all sorts of problems. So even in the KRV case, I think it's been a very, very big challenge to get.
The SAC has been a very big problem.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends whether you can do any evaporative cooling on these molecules. Yeah.
If they're non-reactive,
they might stick. Yeah. Yeah. So we need to again learn how these molecules interact. The first step.
But I guess my question is if there's no sticking, then would it not be better to first pull the lambda and the lattice?
It could well be. I mean, the lattice actually gives you it helps in the magneto association step because you're really you're forcing these two atoms together. So I think in principle you can get better magneto association. So I think it's the preferred route just because of that enhancement.
And how imperfect is your lattice?
At the moment we don't have a lattice, so can't comment.
So is there actually a sort of this? I don't know, this might be a naive question because I'm sure that people have tried this out, but I don't have ready for me. When you have these your two BCs,
mm-hmm.
and let's go back to AC.
Yeah.
If you have your two BCs, I mean this is from the pictures and what people have done before, it seems to be really the kind of why they kind of you have a phase separation.
Yep.
They are coming pretty close. So is there a way to kind of, at least at the boundary, close to the boundary, carefully tune your interaction such that you can whatever, for example, create rubidiums at the boundary and then kind of widen the boundary or something like that?
So that's why we looked at these broader S-wave resonances in that system, because if we can jump up to those, then in principle, yes, we can actually remove this immiscible problem completely. The caveat is that as soon as you jump away from 20 Gauss with cesium, its scattering length becomes enormous. So you don't have very long because the cesium basically just destroys itself quite rapidly. But this, I think the games, I mean, that you need to play in, which is, I think, what Christoph Nagel is exploring in Innsbruck, is that actually, if you can put, for example, cesium in a lattice to start with, such that when you jump up in the scattering length, it's not a problem anymore, then potentially you can then change the interspecies interactions and get things to mix. So I guess the bottom line is it's a lot more complicated than first thought.
How big is the gradient in terms of trap? I mean, you actually have no many names of the appreciable in the trap or conversion efficiency.
Oh, you're worrying about how the magnetic how the magnetic field varies across the trap.
Yeah, when you actually try to associate.
Yeah, so I guess.
You're talking about narrow things. Cesium.
Yes, yeah, so the resonance is quite.
You're surprised you have the gradient in the only cesium experiment.
Yes, there's only cesium here, yeah.
But you keep the gradient
cells. Yeah, that's just to levitate our trap. So it allows us to go down to a very. So for cesium, even in this magic window, you want to go to quite a weak trap. So we go to very low laser power to make a very shallow and weakly confining trap. And if we took the gradient off, gravity would just tip everything out. So we leave the magnetic field gradient on in order to keep this this trap from everything just spilling out. Yeah. And yes, I guess, so the gradient is about 30 gauss per centimeter or so. And I guess the confinement is about 20 microns or something. So there is a small, I think it was 50 milligauss or something, spread across the cloud. So yes, the association won't happen. It somehow, I guess if we sweep right across, it happens sequentially through the cloud. Yeah. And one of the questions we had was when, which I'd be interested if anybody had the answer in, is when we did this experiment, of course, what we were dreaming of was actually seeing interference here. Right? That actually we start with a BEC and we couple out a molecular cloud from a BEC, and it just wasn't clear what the coherence properties of that was, such that when we overlap two molecular clouds from a, both created from a BEC, what we were hoping to see was some nice interference.
Were they coming from the same BEC?
They're coming from the same BEC, yeah.
But from between the longer
point already? Possibly. I mean, it's 9 milliseconds is the time.
What's the characterization of the drop? It's got to be some sort of fluid.
It's very dilute. It's a dilute, few 10 to the 9 density of molecules.
Interesting for this type of metallurgy, 9 years of the gravitation may or may not show up.
Possibly, yeah.
If you would make it coherent from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because there was this debate between two, etc., whether there is or not.
Yeah. It's a very, it's some kind of very interesting atom stroke molecule laser in some sense, because of course in each of these pulses there's an even number of atoms, right? So you're always creating pulses with even numbers of atoms. I don't know whether that's of interest to anybody, but it's certainly different from the normal output coupling.
You can say that we can see when it's dropped.
I don't know. It's
So how many are in each of these?
In these? Kind of 8,000 or so molecules.
Because it's still sizable enough to be quite easy.
You have a
procedure
just this big, and you're creating some sort of fraction, tenth of them have become molecules. So maybe that's the same spatial shape to paint on. But that would be easy to see itself, molecules. Who are there? Well, sorry, that could be separation.
If you would let them just drop down, they would have to stop one to see whether they are still interfering in the magnetic
field. Yeah.
Question. Is that actually? These are probably not taken in one experiment, but you just took them.
So these time sequences are separate iterations of the experiment. But in each iteration of the experiment, we create these two.
But because it looks like that your two clouds actually have rather different momenta. And the question is whether these different momenta are already enough to keep them from
interfering. Possibly, yeah. Yeah. No, they have different momenta, but I mean, we can control that by essentially the timing of when we release them. So when we first tried to do this, we weren't able to get them to cross, and effectively we can tune tune the velocity at which the two clouds cross. But yeah, so far we haven't seen any effect of the fact that they cross. They just seem to pass through one another. Yeah, which is a little disappointing.
Also, about magnetic field gradient. I mean, it's in a very narrow resonance. Could you put the resonance somewhere in the cloud? And so on one side it would be above the resonance, and the other side is above.
Yeah.
And if the width was smaller than the interparticle spacing, then it might have more to pass because you'd be two particles in the same. Is that doable? Or?
I think that's doable. I mean, you have to worry a little bit about the magnetic field stability, I guess.
With filters, you have all sorts of other things. They'll be normal.
Yeah, you have different. Yeah.
Do you want to talk to them?
Yes.
Do you want to take a little break?
Yes.